Wow, we are so thankful.
That's the sound of Elisa getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be providing a refrigerator for her foster youth and filling it with food. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on a fuel-efficient Honda, like the 2024 Accord Hybrid. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
Hello and welcome back to the Professional Book Nerds Podcast. This is Joe. Welcome. Before we dive into today's episode, remember to rate, review, and subscribe, or if you get your podcast or you're listening, we would love to hear from you. And those reviews really help share us with the rest of the world so we can find more listeners just like you. If you want to follow us on social media, we're on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ProBookNerds. You can find us on our website, ProfessionalBookNerds.com, or you can email ProfessionalBookNerds@Overdrive.com. to send an email our way. With that, let's get into today's interview with Adam Sass. My guest today is making a welcome return to PBN. Last year, we talked about his sophomore novel, The 99 Boyfriends of Micah Summers. His debut YA novel, Surrender Your Sons, was named a Best Book of the Year by Kirkus, and Forward Indies, Best First Novel for Young Readers by ALA Booklist, won the gold medal for YA fiction at the IPPI Awards, and was a selection for ALA's Rainbow Booklist for 2022. Micah Summers was named a Best Book of 2022 by 17 Magazine and the Children's Book Council, as well as receiving rave-starred reviews from ALA Booklist and the School Library Journal. Here to talk his new book that's teen slasher Scream meets Clueless, it's Adam Sass. Adam, welcome back.
I'm so happy to be here.
We're so glad to have you back on the podcast. And of course, to talk about Your Lonely Nights Are Over, could you start us off with telling us a bit about the book?
Sure. So, I mean, the quick pitch for this is it's Scream meets Clueless. It's a teen slasher, straight out of, sort of Scream era. I know what you did last summer, Urban Legend, you know, that sort of, you know, that 90s dimension films era. Really a good, strong heyday for slashers. But it's a slasher that's really about queer best friendship. Because my last book, The 99 Boyfriends of Micah Summers, which we talked about, was a romantic, you know, like a more traditional gay boy rom-com. I wanted to really, with this one, celebrate and delve into a lot of the intimacy that can be there in a queer best friendship between two queer boys. So this was something that was very important to me to kind of showcase how just as important, if not more important, sometimes those friendships can be to your romantic partners. And so we've got these two main characters, Deary and Cole, who have been best friends since the beginning of time. And this is really where the Clueless comes in, because they're very like gorgeous and popular and like, you know, everyone's talking about them and all that. But like, they're really like, but like in Clueless, like Cher and Dion are like essentially good people. They don't need to go through some big reckoning like the in Mean Girls. It's a little bit more like people project onto them. And that's really what happens with Deary and Cole, is the rest of the people in the high school's LGBTQ queer club project a lot of things on, and frankly, a lot of insecurities onto them. Because Deary and Cole are not dating themselves, and they're not dating anyone, period. In fact, they're in a suburb of Tucson. And they kind of keep just rolling over to Tucson and hooking up with local high school boys there and are happy with their lives. And a lot of people in that queer club are like, these people are bad for the community. They are toxic. they are toxic for all of this, you know, and they do all this projection. So we begin the story with this sort of, I guess, war within the club. You have those sort of the rest of the queer club, which Deary and Cole call the flops. And because there's jealous flops.
Yep.
And then there's Deary and Cole. And there's a sort of push-pull of like, how involved can they get into, you know, the local high school queer community. And then into this drama comes a masked killer, Mr. Sandman, who's was like the Zodiac killer, was sort of at large about 50 years ago, was never caught or identified. Nobody knows what happened. But one day he just kind of disappeared. And then there's this new, like, kind of Hulu Netflixy sort of docuseries documenting the Mr. Sandman killings from the 70s, and everyone in the school becomes like, they get Mr. Sandman fever. And but then people from the queer clubs start to become targeted by these notes that used to be left by Mr. Sandman, and people are like, are these notes real? Are they a prank? Is this the old Mr. Sandman from before? Is this a copycat? And as bodies start to pile up, because of this projection and because of all of this animosity that the club has built up over Deary and Cole find themselves essentially being blamed for these crimes, and the killer begins to frame them. So that's so really like the plot of Young and the Nights Are Over is these sort of pretty popular boy best friends who are just very annoyed that they have to go solve this murder spree, because if they don't, they're going to be blamed or they will be dead themselves. So it's a lot. It's like 40% humor. I would say it's 50% humor, 50% scares. Like, it's just as much humor as scary.
And that is what truly makes it, if you made Clueless, Scream. Like, it's it's exactly that. You've got the humor, you've got the camp, you've got the slasher, and there are just those true crime moments that you're sitting with and you're just going, oh, this is really happening. But that description, there are so many things that jump out that I want to go like, okay, what about this? What about this? But we'll start easy. What's your favorite scary movie?
So I've had to cycle through this a lot, and I have many. One of my favorites, the one that keeps coming to mind when I am asked this question on my tour for this book, is The Exorcist. I really love it. Obviously, I'm loving that it's coming back. I'm skeptical, but of course, why wouldn't anybody be? You know, we're not, you know, no movie is safe right now. And we got Ellen Burstyn coming back. Ellen Burstyn is so good in the original Exorcist. And a big thing of what I love that The Exorcist does that I tried to do in New England Nights Are Over was, I love when horror is about characters who are wrapped up in their own drama before the horror even begins, because that's kind of how it would happen in real life. Like, it would be like, you'd be worried about your bank account and your job and something up with your, like, and you got to walk your dog and someone's up with your kid. You'd be wrapped up in a bunch of crap that to you was like, this is, I'm having such a terrible day. And then, you know, and this is what happens to Ellen Burstyn's character, is like, she is, her biggest concern is like, she's shooting a movie in Washington, D.C. She really can't stand the script. She really can't stand being in this movie. And her ex-husband is like forgetting their daughter's birthday. So she's livid. So she's just, for the first 20 minutes, half an hour at least, like, it's a good chunk of the movie, it's a sort of slow burn when there's sort of ominous things creeping around the corners. She is just like calling the hotel in Rome where the husband is and rampaging, so much so that like she doesn't notice that slowly her daughter is like acting different until suddenly really unignorable things start happening. And I think that to me is like really, really effective horror, because I think it kind of draws you in to like, it just makes it feel more real, because it's like, then it's like all this demon stuff happens. But like, because we've had 20 to 30 minutes of just normal life, and then it slowly kind of is just already there, and then we're off and running with the spinning heads and everything like that. I think that's so effective, and that's kind of what I wanted to do with Your Little Nights Are Over, was for the first chapter, you're really kind of in this queer club squabble over...
Did you send these texts to, right, you know, are exactly you doing all this?
There's a lot of like petty little like, well, what I think is, and a lot of inter-queer community squabbling, which I think anybody listening to this podcast is probably very, unfortunately, very well aware of. Very calming. It's very calming to be around that energy. But then like into that, then comes these slangs, an actual threat, but then like you have to kind of keep up the, there's other things happening. And so it is, it's sort of, by the time the threat comes in, you're sort of already in this sort of locked community.
Right. They're already having to close up ranks and trying to get over their hatred's too strong because they are a community. They know they're a community. They know they have to kind of do this together, but their own distaste and dislike and whatever has come before for one another to really move forward. Knowing your writing style and kind of your process, where did your inspiration for Your Lonely Nights Are Over come from?
Well, so I had a lot of feelings about what I was sort of seeing in the queer community, you know, like, well, you know, being a very online person, and my husband is not very online. And so he's always like very blissfully unaware that all these conversations are happening all the time. And he sees me just like so upset. And he's like, it's almost like I'm like stirring, it's like I'm stirring rat poison into my coffee like every morning. He's like, well, just stop doing that. And I'm like, no.
Doesn't quite work that way. Yeah, kind of have to know.
Right. I'm like, he's like, well, it's making you weak and ill. And I'm like, no, well, you know. So, and I was sort of seeing these troubling conversations where, and it seems to always crop up around like when there's a piece of media or there's really anything. I feel like there's the queer community and I have a complicated relationship where I feel, where I love us so much, but then I feel like we are so prone to just descending so quickly into squabbles over, I don't want to say nothing, but just it gets very small very quickly.
Right.
It gets nitpicky. It gets nitpicky very quickly. And you lose the forest for the trees very quickly, I think, sometimes, especially online. Because then there's some people that I have had like conversations with online where I feel like I'm talking to a brick wall. And then I will see them in person. And they're far more like there's a little more of an exchange of emotion. And I feel like I'm talking to a real person. And I think in general, I don't think that's a queer problem. I think that's like literally an online problem. So it's like you can't just like be like, oh, I wasn't a fan of that movie. There's like a big, you not liking a movie says something about you, and then you liking a movie says something about you. It's a very like intense thing that can escalate so quickly. And so that I was sort of fascinated by those dynamics because I had just finished. So I was working on my debut. I was working on selling my debut, Surrender Your Sons, which is it's about a group of a dozen teens, queer teens, who have to escape from this conversion therapy camp. It's a sort of an adventure thriller. Really loved all those kids. And sort of the arc of that book really is all these sort of individual siloed kids learning to kind of come together and form a community. And so I sort of almost like while I was waiting for this book to sell, I almost wanted to write the sort of dark twin of that, which is how the community can sort of, you know, like the dark side of that, like how it's not necessarily because someone is queer, they've got your back and you can drop your guard around them. Yeah.
Right. That you also have to be a little more mindful of the family that you're finding in the community you're creating, because we're not great alone, but we also have to be protective of our peace in a unit.
Exactly. And I think it's also important to remember that, like, especially, you know, it's very hard. And this is something that online stuff really escalates, which is like individual choices. And I think this particularly pertains to like relationship choices. There are queers who are like in open relationships. There are queers who are in like, polyamorous relationships. There are people who are like, I choose not to be in a relationship. I'm single and I am, hooking up with other people, but that's it. And as long as it's being done consensually and with enthusiastic support and no one's getting hurt, like, it just feels like this shouldn't be anyone else's business. Just focus on your thing. And I've just been noticing a lot of queer people just really not minding their business on this thing, which is weird because it's sort of out of the conservative hand-wringing playbook. And I found that very troubling. And I noticed younger generations doing this. And so I found that to be equally troubling. So this book was sort of an outgrowth of that, where I just saw like how, you know, and it's not necessarily blaming like a young generation or blaming a certain mentality. It is really like, it shows like how when you're very online and or when you're in a closed community with that allows very little air into the room, how you can get really siloed off even within the community, how you can get really like ingrained in your own thinking. And I don't mean politically. I just mean like, I mean like, you know, how like someone is living their life and what exactly that means. So I'm seeing a lot of no business minding.
Which your characters definitely do that in this book when it comes to Cole and Deary, that right?
Nobody minds their business. So like, I'm a millennial and I feel like I was the last generation to really grow up like unsurveillanced. And I feel like this is sort of an unintentional outgrowth of like, there's Ring doorbell cameras everywhere. Like there's just cameras. And you know, your whole youth is online, and sort of, there's an ease of getting into someone's information, because it's so available. And to someone who kind of grew up with like internet being just for looking up Goosebumps facts, like in the mid 90s, like I feel, I don't know, like I,
yeah.
It seems a little wild to me that we're like using it to like figure out people's whole identities and deals and paint their whole situations of their whole lives. And it creates more projection. Then you think you know this person. And that's a big part of the killer, which is the Mr. Sandman, which relates to the title, Your Lonely Nights Are Over. That's a message he will leave on the body after he's killed them. His MO is, he kills lonely people. If you have been recently dumped, if you are chronically single, if you're pining over someone you can't have, if Mr. Sandman decides you are lonely, you could be the next to go. And what this kind of book investigates about that is who decides who's lonely. And there's a lot of projection in that, because I think a lot of people can have lonely moments. But I think some people, and maybe even us sometimes, can go like, can, you know, look at somebody we don't know and go like, oh, that's a shame. You know, like, I feel like they're really lonely or something like that. But like, we don't know. Maybe they're like happy with that. Or maybe they're not, maybe their life isn't like as tragic as we are like projecting onto them. And that's really what the killer does, which is like, they're consumed with this feeling of, this person is unbearably lonely and I have to put them out of their misery. And it's like, who decides?
Right. Yeah. All based off of truly no criteria that anyone can judge. But speaking of Mr. Sandman, how did you go about crafting a killer? I mean, you had to make a kill style, this motive, even all the details of like appearance overall, and then catchphrases, you know, kind of like those key marks of, was this a Mr. Sandman crime? How did you go about this?
I knew like certain things had to be unique, because we knew, you know, because of the Scream comp, Screams are whodunits. They're essentially Agatha Christie stories, which is true. Like, I mean, they're like, the killer is someone you have just seen on screen. Like, they're like, it's not a otherworldly entity like a Freddy or a Jason or a Michael Myers. It's not this like being. It is someone we have met. It's someone we have met. Just a person. If they ever mess with this format, I will be so upset. The second we get like a supernatural who's behind the mask thing, I'm just going to be like, I'm out.
Right, and Scream 15 is where I stop.
I will keep watching, but I'll be frowning about it.
I won't be happy about it, but I'm...
So because I was going to be a mask killer, the mask had to be me. So I was like going through, and I was really tearing through like a lot of like old movies, and just making sure I was like, because I had in my mind, like, here's what I'd like to do. And it was, so Mr. Sandman wears a theatrical tragedy mask, the old drama mask. And I, you know, and I, it's close, but not really that close to the sort of screen, sort of dipping ghost face. Yeah. But it has its own style. In fact, it's a little, there's a Twilight Zone episode called The Masks, where one of them is the sort of permanent frown. And it just really felt very like appropriate for Mr. Salmon, who's just like about loneliness and sadness and all of that. So I was like, so I just tore forever. I was like, is there something where the guy wears a mask? That's the tragedy man. Then there's been a million slashers. So far, I'm sure someone
will let you know online.
Someone will let me know. But yeah, but to my knowledge, this was not used yet. And then as for the killing style, I knew that because this is a dual POV between Deary and Cole, first person, a lot of these kills were going to have to be, for the first half of the book, at least, the kills were going to have to be like off page. And it was a lot of like discovery of bodies versus like towards the back half where you start seeing a lot more like on page Mr. Sandman killings. And it's sort of like Jaws in that way, where it's sort of going to slowly build up. You sort of see this wreckage and then you get to that moment. So I was like, okay, well, if we're going to be finding bodies, you know, if it's a scream, if it's a knife, then you're just going to have like various stab wounds. I don't know, you know, like didn't seem dramatic enough, you know. And then I loved the idea of, you know, it was like watching Clue one night, like, and it was Yvette the maid, and she gets like strangled with the rope. And like, she's sort of like laying across the billiard table, and it's this very architected way that Colleen Camp, the actress, is sort of laid across the table, sort of holding the rope. And I just thought it was a very dramatic, like, it was like, because we're talking about like sort of a queer, this villain is sort of in a queer space. And so like, there is going to be a little bit of a grandness. There's gonna be a little showiness to it.
Gotta have some drama. Yeah,
exactly. So there isn't, it's a noose, but it's a noose of razor wire, which is very messed up.
It is.
Yeah, that's very nasty. So yeah, that's how Mr. Salmon came to be.
So you did mention the dual perspective between Deary and Cole. I wanted to talk about what made you decide to write from two perspectives and to kind of set up, as the book goes on, without spoiling, the idea of one of them becoming unreliable through abuse, trauma, all of that, where the other is being set up as unreliable for like just situations of the color of his skin and the preconceived notions of police. And if you are a bitchy gay, like, you know, what people are ready to blame you. So how did you decide on two perspectives and that build?
Your Lonely Nights Are Over was originally, when I sold it, it was called Deary. And it was just originally from his point of view. And then and then after a while, my editor, like pretty early on in the process, was like, Cole is such a bombastic character. He's like jumping off the page. And he like has access to a lot. Like Cole is the Poirot of this. Like he's he's got the investigative skills. I feel like you've got like sort of two investigative styles. You've got Cole is our sort of Agatha Christie detective who is very analytical and is spotting inconsistencies and little moments like that. And then Deary is...
he's the scream queen. He's the one who's like, I'll use myself truly, as bait.
Yeah, Deary is truly going through this in a very like sort of emotional, intuitive way. Like, so you almost like you have these sort of like traditional, you know, detective story, detective character. And then you have a scream queen who are best friends. And the two perspectives. So she suggested doing two perspectives, my editor. Right away, it was very clear that you were going to get with Cole, you were going to get very, very like sharp eyed, perceptive, like you were going to be picking up a lot of clues, a lot of like Cole chapters are, and it evenly goes back and forth. You do Deary Cole, Deary Cole. Every time you're in a Cole chapter, you like pick up on clues, you're collecting evidence essentially as a reader, you're picking up on like behavior patterns and this and that. You have a very analytical experience. And also because like, and you have a really like clear-eyed thing because Cole is Latinx. And since they are both being blamed for these crimes, Cole's racial identity, the sort of the eye of the law is far more intense on him. And that stress and strain starts to shake apart the friendship between Deary and Cole as the story goes on. It's sort of like, that's the big sort of existential threat. It's not even them going to jail or them dying. It's like, will their connection as people maintain? What can be more harrowing, honestly, sometimes if you feel that connection fraying. So in Cole's chapters, I knew you were going to get this very clear-eyed, here's what's happening. These people are jealous. These law enforcement people are, like, you know, clearly biased. They're biased. Yeah. Like, and you have these, very, like, you're allowed clarity in the Cole chapters. Deary's chapters, Deary is far more emotional. And Deary, you sort of get lost in these dream spaces, almost to the point where he might be an unreliable narrator.
Hey there. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema,
our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.
Hello, and welcome to Novel Conversations, a podcast about the world's greatest stories. I'm your host, Frank Lavallo. And for each episode of Novel Conversations, I talk to two readers about one book. And together, we summarize the story for you. We introduce you to the characters, we tell you what happens to them, and we read from the book along the way. So if you love hearing a good story, you're in the right place. Our 9th season is coming this fall. Tune in to hear from some of the all-time great authors, Charles Dickens, Jules Verne, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and more. Subscribe to Novel Conversations wherever you listen to podcasts.
Because he has this sort of foggy memory about certain moments that happen. And you think maybe, like, he seems to be having gaps of memory. You know, he seems to be sort of not tracking everything that's coming through. He's very concerned about maintaining his connection with Cole. He's very concerned with keeping everyone safe. Beyond that, those are his two primary objectives. So he's got this very emotional kind of arc. And Cole is like a tank just going for, like, unmask this. As soon as we unmask this person, everything else can then heal. Yes. And Deary is like, no, let's solve it on the fly.
I have to fix our friendship and right. Get a boyfriend. And
right. And so Deary is a little bit of a poor baby who is just kind of a little adrift. And so you get a lot of the, in his chapters, you get these sort of, you know, I really loved writing him, sort of beautiful, dreamy, ponderings. And Deary is someone who is depressed and anxious. And I think I read somewhere that was when you have a lot of depression, your sort of mind is fixated on the past. And then anxiety is your mind is fixated on the future and what it could be. And Cole is very present. But Deary is stuck in both the past and the worrisome future. He's very rarely present, which is why a lot of his first person reportage to you, the reader, you know, has to be kind of looked at a little bit askew.
It's definitely frenetic, but it's really great for the pacing to have these two perspectives of this is my fact-finding time. This is my, wait, what am I supposed to pull out? Like, either way, you have this really fun choose-your-own-adventure experience to try to see if you can figure it out as we, like, race toward the end. The flip side of this, you have so many characters, and you're not afraid to kill your characters in this book especially. Right. What did it feel like to build all of these people who feel like fully formed humans and then kill them? And how did you decide when, where, all that? I mean, you knew how they were going to die because killer has an MO, but.
It's hard. And I think that's, like, it's so funny because I get very, like, because I'm a very emotional person. When it comes to, like, horror and, like, killing off characters, I get very, like, that's the job, Buttercup. You got to do, they got to go. We all loved Tatum from Scream, and she got to get crushed in the garage door. You know, there's a lot of people in these movies where I'm like, oh, I wish that person had not. I wish Parker Posey's character had survived. I think she's going to secretly survive that.
I mean, hey, they brought back Kirby.
They brought Kirby. I think, like, listen, while we're doing the goofy everybody comes back thing.
Right. Let's make the most of it.
Make her come back. So it's hard, but also like, so a big thing that I knew going into this is I was like, well, so I had done Surrender Your Sons, which is, I was pitching as an adventure thriller from a conversion camp, which is heavy topic that I have just pitched to you as zippy adventure. And that's truly because, and it's not because I'm trying to be flippant, it's because I wanted to give all of these kids agency, and fun agency, to have fun, to connect with each other. And I think by the end of Surrender Your Sons, you are seeing like these characters are laughing and being chummy together. They are getting through one of the most traumatic events they'll ever go through. And they're doing so with joy and laughter with each other. And that's how you get through it. And that's kind of where, and so I knew though, after the reception of that book, and it was well received, but there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of content warnings because it was a very, it's an intense subject matter. And I know certain folks had I don't know if I'm really ready for like a heavy book right now, or sort of anything where it's like, it's hard to do queer thrillers at all because you're sort of saying I'm endangering queer lives in this story. And when I announced that I was like doing like a queer slasher where like the victims were all members of a queer club, you know, a lot of people were just very excited, but like even people who were excited, some of them were like, so how many queer people die horribly in this? And I was
like, great question.
I understand your fears. Not a great time to, like, and it's never a great time to like see a bunch of queer characters get killed, but.
There's also a lot of great queer victory. So
there's a lot of great queer victory. No, exactly. But I was like, my whole thing is I was like, listen, I have just wanted to put together a slasher that is for the queer community. You know, and Scream is really for the queer community, but you know, that's a big tent, and we're in that tent. This was like, this is a Just Us thing. So I knew like to counteract that, like 95% of the characters with major speaking roles in this book are queer, on page queer, self-identified. So, and so I knew there was going to be so much identity coverage everywhere that I could start killing. And it wouldn't be like, oh, you've killed the one queer person in the story. Like that's everybody's sort of fear, you know, like, cause it's like you get attached, and we've all suffered through decades of that. Where it's like, oh, there's the one queer character, and then like, oh, they're not gonna maybe make it, and then they get killed, and then maybe another season goes by and they'll bring in a new one. And it's we've been burned. So I really wanted to make sure that right away from the jump, the readers knew from chapter one, where they meet a dozen queer people, that you were gonna be fine. I wanted people to like sort of sit back and get lost in the dream of the book and just have that fun Scream adventure and not worry as much as they could, not worry about like, you know, it's not queer death. This is just they're not being targeted because they are queer. It's all for a different purpose.
Right. That we are not talking a final girl story here. We are talking a true like teen slasher. It is that there can be a group at the end, that it can be more than one person.
There are survivors. Yes, survivors. Yes.
There are survivors. Now, looking at some of that setting and some of our ancillary cast here, we're in Arizona, as you said, suburb of Tucson. We're kind of mainly in the high school, specifically the music room or the library or the drive-in. Those are kind of like the big places outside of Cole and Deary's houses, or, you know, in the Zoom call with everyone else when we're, you know.
Yeah.
Have fun reading that later, y'all. First, of course, I have to ask from Overdrive, what inspired you to add a librarian to the cast?
Oh my gosh, yes. So I knew the queer club would need like a teacher figure. like a classroom sponsor, like a club sponsor, who was faculty. And I thought librarian would be good because, again, I really love, you know, so like Buffy fans will notice that the geography of this library is very familiar.
And, just a little.
Yes, your mind can create a map very easily this way. And so I was just kind of picturing like, you know, oh, great. Like they congregate sort of in a library space. This is like a character, because that's the thing, like where it's like libraries are safe spaces. Librarians are often like one of the safest
people around. Yeah,
people to come to, you know, when you're queer in school. And so this was a character who was going to be very instrumental in making the club feel safe. Then she's very quickly in over her head.
Very quickly.
Yes, very quickly.
And then thinking about the drive-in, do you have a love for a drive-in?
I do. Well, I have a love for I wanted this book to kind of feel like
both like new and nostalgic.
Yes. I wanted it to have that sort of like now channeling the 50s. And so this was, that's why like a lot of the, I think probably most specifically Darian Cole, are like almost channeling like 50s teenage cool.
Yeah.
Cole is like, I've got my jacket and I'm like mad at everybody and like, don't touch my hot red car.
I was going to say he's about his car.
He's about his car. Like it's very like, it's very just 50s. And then I specifically wrote Deary in the first chapter to have like this lavender neckerchief, kind of the one she wears in Rebel Without a Cause. Like a 50s sort of like guy's best girl. And she's cool, but she's like a little, you know, he's vaping, you know, like, it's just like the sort of like phony cool, but just like they were channeling a different era. Like they are just like, I wanted Deary and Cole to feel like aliens in this town and within their own community, that like they were just too cool, literally too cool for school. That like they were just like, of course they didn't belong in this club. Like, they didn't have anything in common with anybody. And everyone was fascinated. Yeah.
They had no problem with who they were trying to be. Like, right. They were the kids who already had it together and knew where they were going to go to make their first mistakes kind of thing.
Exactly. So, like, they're very, like, again, I wanted them to feel like they were, like, of a different time, of a different place, otherworldly.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah. From that perspective, approach that. And so that's why, like, the drive, and I was like, okay, well, then we'll have this sort of thing. And there's like sort of a roadside burger thing. And there was all these sort of like, especially the drive-in sort of section around the one-third mark, just gets very like, you know, we're playing old 50s sci-fi trailers. You're playing all this sort of like B-movie stuff. And that was really the inspiration. Like, I was like, you could do a lot of that in the 50s, but it's just happening now.
Right. It's very timeless, current. It has a good tap dance around, you know, kind of what we're looking for. And thinking of that, I know you love your authenticity writers. How was it to work on, because me trying to understand what kids today are into or doing or what high school is like for them is a scary thought. What was it like creating these characters that you may only relate to in certain portions, you may not relate to at all, you may fully relate to, but how did your work with authenticity writers and planning these different kids out go?
So my authenticity writers this time, you know, there was, I would say, well, first of all, I do like to keep in touch with the young people. Because a big part
You're
of
brave,
I do, yes. A big part of the framing of Deary and Cole involves planting evidence in their locker. And for those listening, if you do not have teenage kids yourself, and if you're not a teenager yourself, you should know kids do not go to their lockers anymore. Their lockers are assigned, but there's just no reason to go. So like very, like there was a, so there is a line in that where it was like,
Deary never hasn't been to his locker in 6 months.
Right. And it just felt so strange, but like, you know, but like it does make sense. And like, the more electronic everything gets, but it used to be so like, you have to live there, and whoever was, next to your locker was very important.
It mattered so much. And having graduated high school in 2011, I could not imagine not going to my locker.
You are such a child. I graduated high school in 2001.
My sister did too.
There we go. So I will tell you, like, in that day, even, like, the locker was like, you might as well just have class to your locker. It was a very important location. So to rewire my brain on that was, like, very interesting process. Because I had a whole thing where, like, they went back to the locker. It very quickly just had to go.
They went, no, not how it works. I mean, it makes so much sense, though.
I should have just set the whole thing back in the 50s and just like, and been like, okay, yeah, they're all in the 50s and they're all at the lockers and no one has a cell phone.
And they're all having a sock hop. And
yeah, exactly.
But that's the thing. So without being today, you wouldn't have the chance for this true crime element and those really wonderful interstitials. How did you decide to bring in, because I love a book within a book, a podcast in a book, all of that. So this kind of thing of a documentary piece, what was the motivation there? Was this a later ad?
Well, I'm like you, I love an interstitial. I think people need to mark time, especially in a book like this, which is like, it's about 40 or so chapters. I think it's 40 chapters. And it is, like, I tell people, like, around, if you're reading it for the first time, chapter 26 is where you should stop for the night. Because if you proceed, if you have anything to do in the morning, if you, like, I have heard this from many people. I've told them, I'm like, stop at 26, then you're going to get to 27, and it just keeps going. And you do not get a, like, you are going to be, if you care about these characters at all, you will keep going until you reach 40. So I knew we needed breath in there. We could not just be like 40 miles of bad road where it was just like, and like, it was just like the thing. We needed some break in there. And the interstitials were, you know, you don't have to twist my arm to do an interstitial, but it was always kind of part of it. But I came across the idea of doing this as a docuseries, and doing sort of like episode descriptor, like it's almost like this was like on Netflix, where it's like that little paragraph you would see, maybe a little longer than that for the episode description. And because I knew everybody in the school was going to have Mr. Sandman fever, that he was going to have all these rules, like, that this was not going to be a new killer where we had to learn the rules, that this was like a killer from forever ago where a lot of the characters already knew the rules from the show. So I knew the reader needed to get caught up, and it was probably best if they did it in a way where, like, Cole wasn't stopping to say things that he already knew. Because Cole's, like, the one who's way more into the show. Deary, like, opens the book basically being, like, everyone's really into the show. I don't like it. I'm very annoyed by everybody. I kind of wish the show would go away. And then immediately his life becomes the show. I knew, like, the docuseries stuff seemed like a good way to sort of impart sort of enough of a vibe about, like, who Mr. Sandman was, sort of what the MO was, what are the basics, what are we talking about? And then the more important thing, like, emotionally, what did it do to the community? So, like, Mr. Sandman was huge in the 70s in his local community of San Diego. And then this is in Arizona. So it's even more confusing. Like, is this the old guy or not? What was kind of neat to do about this was when you start killing lonely people, and if you're lonely, if you've been dumped, or if you're pining over someone, and that gets you killed, then it started this just rash of people getting together, and people who really wanted to break up, who should have broken up, staying together. And then that led to, they had to get married, and then they had kids together. Like, they're like, it's a bit metaphorical, because it is sort of this fear of loneliness, this fear of death. The loneliness is death, this fear of this loneliness death that causes people to stay in bad situations, to pair up with people who are not just, you know, exactly. And they don't realize that you can be with someone and you could be lonelier than you ever were when you were single. And it's a big thesis of the book. Because I like to say, this is, I, you know, not really a spoiler here, but I like this because I do like to say this enough because I knew this was going to be an anti-romance book because everyone by the, you know, everyone at the end of this book ends up either single or dead.
Yep.
So like the, no relationship survives this book either through death or through a breakup. This is definitely, and then for a lot of the single folks, maybe happily so, this is not necessarily a an indictment on single equals loneliness.
Right. It's a really important look at happiness and what makes the most sense for you. Yeah. Now, you have mentioned it, but you were writing this while you were selling Surrender Your Sons. Yeah. What is it like to see this coming out into the world quite a few years later?
5 years. This was 2018, madness, and Surrender Your Sons took about the same time, maybe a year or so longer.
Oh, wow.
So these two books, these two thrillers, just forever, taking forever to find their way out. And then both, in my opinion, just being so worth it by the time we get out, like both in their proper form. It's wild. And this didn't even really go through that many iterations. It just got caught up in a lot of traffic because Surrender Your Sons had to come out. And then I ended up writing 99 Boyfriends of Micah Summers first, because just the way the schedule was working, like it just seemed like that was going to be the next best one while I waited to see what I was going to do with this next thriller. And so they've been with me forever. It's very, this is my third book out, and it always just gets so sweetly melancholic because it's just like,
you're like letting it go into the world.
I know, because I'm just like, I've been writing these kids forever, and I love writing them so much. And now they have to go off, and I'm not going to be writing them ever again. Never say never, but I'm not in charge of a lot of that, but as much as I can tell, this is the end of the road for me and these kids. And it's a very tough thing to say out loud. Because I love them. So they are so real to me.
It is tough to hear that, like, right, each here having all of your books be standalone, because I think of the relationship that I, as a reader, when I've read all of them, just kind of going like, would I love more of them? Yes. But also I feel like I end with that like, melancholy as well, where I'm like, I know I'm not going to get any more, but I'm really happy for what I got.
I know. It's always so sad finishing. It's like they can always be revisited. And that
rampant rereader.
good. I'm same. And so I do encourage people to do that. But closing the door on some of them helps me get ready for the next ones. Who I love as well. So, it gives me more time with the next folks.
So on that, you've put two thrillers out into the world and a romance. What yes. can you talk about are you working on currently?
So just finished copy edits on my fourth book, which is coming out July 16th, 2024. So very soon, 10 months from now, very soon.
Very soon.
Very close together. Very soon. I'll be back here probably talking to you very soon. I'll be like,
yep.
I'll just stay on the Zoom.
Yeah, just keep it open in the background.
Right. So it's called Cursed Boys and Broken Hearts. This is a companion novel set in the world of 99 Boyfriends of Micah Summers. It's not a sequel. It just is it's sort of a sort of expansion of that world.
This is where I can say I may or may not have heard something about that after we stopped recording this time last year.
Yes, this is very true. You did hear about this. So this has been long in the works, but now it is a finished book because I think probably the last time I was still drafting it because it was this one had to be drafted very rapidly. And I was very lucky that this one kind of just shot out of me, like fully formed. And this one is, so we're 99 Boyfriends is a Cinderella remix from the Prince's point of view. This is a Beauty and the Beast remix from the Beast's point of view. And this follows the character Grant Rossi, who is a fashion designer we met in the first book. He is feeling extremely unlucky in love and depressed about it. And so much of the beast of the Beauty and the Beast stuff comes out in this, in Grant's depression and self-hatred. This is sort of the vessel with which I'm sort of telling that part of the story. And Grant is in Chicago and just sort of wallowing. He just graduated high school, and he doesn't have his college plan set up yet. He was supposed to. And then just time got away, and he has just been kind of becoming unmoored from life, because he's feeling very cursed, because just so many guys in a row, you know, he's the starter boyfriend, and he seems cursed to be the starter boyfriend for a lot of people before they get with their quote real boyfriend, and before they before they come to their senses and realize Grant has to go. And it's become a pattern for him. So he's Grant is a sort of magical thinking type guy who notices patterns everywhere and really believes in them. And to his own detriment, he believes that like this curse is very real. And so his mom convinces him to at least get out of the house, go, you know, take the train 3 hours into the country, go to the family bed and breakfast and winery, which has been in the family since World War II. It's called Vero Rosetto. And is this, they have their own family label called the Wishing Rose. It's all very like rose imagery there, Beauty and the Beast stuff. And he gets there. And so when he was growing up, he used to spend every summer there with his siblings and cousins. And he even had a best friend who lived in town there that he would see every summer named Ben. And over the years, Grant realized like, oh, he really had it. Like he was really in love with Ben. And then that one summer when he was 13, it ended very horribly. They had a huge fight and they never spoke again. And it happened right when Grant's grandmother passed away. So at that point, and she was running Vero Rosetto. And so when she passed, a lot of the family sort of stopped coming. She was sort of the glue that held the family together. And sort of that sort of was sort of the great parting, and no one returned to Vero Rosetto. So many years, 5 years have passed. And Grant's aunt, Aunt Ro, she's been running the place, and she's just completely underwater. Like the things that, like the house is in disrepair, very Beauty and the Beast, like oh, the West Wing. And it's this whole like dilapidated, glorious manner. And so Grant comes there, and his Aunt Ro is like, well, you know, please, I'm so glad you're here. It's so good to have you back again. Would you please, like, we're gonna lose this house if we can't get, you know, guests to start coming back. And we need to have, you know, we need to do a lot of these repairs. Can you help with the repairs? And he's like, all right, fine. And she's like, great. I can only hire one person on the staff. I've got this gardener. He's gotta handle the grounds, and you work with him. And he's like, fine. He goes out to meet the gardener, and it is Ben, his childhood crush, who devastated him, began his curse, and he's all grown up, and he's looking very good, and he's very furious about it. And so kind of what ensues is, it's, I call it a hate fest, because enemies to lovers is not intense enough, because they hate each other. So it is, I say Beauty and the Beast, and where Grant is the Beast, but also like Ben is also the Beast, so it's like a Beast and the Beast,
it's just hatred.
No, that's the, you know, that's the line from the first chapter of the book. It's like, who better to love a beast than another beast? Bells are out this year. So,
yeah. What a perfect first line.
The dark sided book, the very dark sided energy, but it's romance, but it's like a gothic romance. Everyone is, well, I love it because like Grant is just, it's probably a lot of me in it, because like it's just very in love with his own drama, and we all relate to that. He's in love with his own drama, and unfortunately we can relate.
Unfortunately, usually too real. Well, I can't wait for that, and then I'm hoping you also have another thriller in the tank as well.
Nothing to announce just yet, but we're it's cooking, we're working.
Oh, I love it. I love that I get everything I need. I get a thriller, follow it up with a romance, and you know, I'm into this pattern.
it's great. I mean, I didn't mean to plan it this way, where I'm kind of doing one on, one off, but you know, I feel like the thrillers have like these like friendships that are strong romances, and then I have these romances that are extremely suspenseful. Yes. Yeah, just so
you've kind of blended them at the same time.
Yeah, it's all kind of from the same world. Yeah.
I love it. Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming back and for talking about Your Lonely Nights Are Over.
Oh, please, my pleasure.
Well, listeners, remember, Your Lonely Nights Are Over is already out, so go and get you a copy and enjoy Deary and Cole. Thank you all so much for joining us, and happy reading.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode on overdrive.com or in Libby. Our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Emma Dwyer and Joe Skelly and presented by Overdrive. To learn more, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
There is no hood like parenthood. When you meet a fellow parent, you just kind of get each other on a whole nother level. Hi, I'm Kanika Chanda Gupta. I'm a former CNN journalist, mom of three, including twins, and host of That's Total Mom Sense, the podcast. I interview changemakers on their life lessons, legacy, and superpower of intuition, aka their mom sense and dad sense. I've had some pretty amazing parents on my show.
Hey, what's up? I'm Kelly Rowland.
Hi, this is Chelsea Clinton.
It's me, Bobby Brown. Can't wait to share my story.
Episodes release every Thursday. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and on YouTube. Join my tribe at thatstotalmomsense.com and follow me on Instagram at Kanika Chanda Gupta. I'm thrilled to be on this journey with you.